Page 130. He leaves his clothes and shoes in the anteroom, and a friend berates him for his worn and inappropriate shoes. Abu Qasim replies that they are still serviceable, and he enters the bath with his friend. Later, a powerful judge also comes to the baths and disrobes, leaving behind an elegant pair of slippers. Meanwhile, Abu Qasim departs from the bath and cannot find his old slippers. In their place, he finds a new and beautiful pair of shoes, and presuming these to be a present from his friend, he puts them on and leaves. When the judge leaves, his own slippers are missing, and all he can find are a miserable, tawdry pair of slippers, which everyone knows belong to the miser Abu Qasim. The judge is angry, servants are dispatched to retrieve the missing slippers, and they are soon found upon the very feet of the thief, who is hauled into court before the magistrate and severely fined. Abu Qasim curses his bad luck and, once home, flings the unlucky slippers out of his window where they fall into the muddy Tigris River. Page 131. Some days later, a group of fishermen haul in their catch and find, along with some fish, the slippers of Abu Qasim. The hobnails of these slippers have torn their nets. Enraged, they throw the soggy slippers through an open window. The window happens to be that of Abu Qasim. The slippers fall upon the newly purchased glassware and smash it all. Abu Qasim is heartbroken and grieves as only a stingy miser can. He vows the wretched slippers shall do him no further harm, and, to be certain, goes to his garden with a shovel and buries them. As it happens, his next-door neighbor sees Abu Qasim digging, a menial task fit only for a servant. The neighbor assumes that if the master of the house is doing this to himself, it must be in order to bury treasure. Thus, the neighbor goes to the caliph and informs on Abu Qasim, for according to the laws of the land, any treasure found in the ground is the property of the caliph. Abu Qasim is called before the caliph, and when he reports that he buried only a pair of old slippers, the court laughs uproariously at the obviousness of the merchant's attempt to conceal his true and illegal purpose. Page 132. The caliph is angry to be thought such a fool as to be given the silly lie, and increases the magnitude of his fine accordingly. Abu Qasim is thunderstruck when sentence is passed, and yet he is obliged to pay. Abu Qasim is now determined to be rid of his slippers once and for all. To be certain of no further trouble, he makes a pilgrimage far from town and drops the slippers into a distant pond, watching them sink to the bottom with satisfaction. But the pond feeds the city's water supply, and eventually the slippers clog the pipes. Guards dispatched to release the stricture find the slippers and recognize them. For everyone knows the slippers of this notorious miser. Abu Qasim is again brought before the caliph on a charge of befouling the water of the town, and his fine is much greater than before. The slippers are returned to him. Now Abu Qasim determines to burn the slippers, but they are still wet, so he sets them on the balcony to dry. A dog sees them and plays with them. One of the slippers falls from his jaws and drops to the street far below, where it strikes a woman passing by. Page 133. The woman is pregnant, and the force of the blow causes a miscarriage. Her husband runs to the court to seek damages, which are awarded plentifully, and Abu Qasim, now a broken and impoverished man, is obliged to pay. The slightly literal Arabic moral states that this story illustrates what evils can befall a man who does not change his slippers often enough. But undoubtedly, the undercurrent to the tale, the idea of a man who cannot shake off some burden, was what disturbed the Northmen. End of quote. Now, the night passed with further celebrations, and all the warriors of Bulliwif disported in a careful fashion. I saw the son Wiglaf glaring at Bulliwif before leaving the hall, but Bulliwif paid no attention, preferring the ministrations of slave girls and freeborn women. After a time, I slept. In the morning, I awoke to the sounds of hammering, and, venturing from the great hall of Herat, I found all the peoples of the kingdom of Hrothgar at work on defenses. Page 134. These were being laid out in preliminary fashion. Horses drew up quantities of fence posts, which warriors sharpened to points. Bulliwif himself directed the placement of defense works by making scratches in the ground with the tip of his sword. For this he did not use his great sword, Runding, but rather some other sword. I do not know if there was a reason for this. Upon the middle portion of the day, the woman, who was called the Angel of Death, footnote 4, came and cast bones on the ground, and made incantations over them, and announced that the mist would come that night. Upon hearing this, Bullywiff called for all work to cease, and a great banquet to be prepared. In this manner all the people concurred and ceased their efforts. I inquired of Hergar why there should be a banquet, but he replied to me that I had too many questions. It is also true that I had timed my inquiry badly, for he was posturing before a blonde slave girl who smiled warmly in his direction. Now in the latter part of the day, Bullywiff called together all his warriors and said to them, "Prepare for battle," and they agreed and wished luck to one another, while all about us the banquet was being made ready. Footnote 4. This is not the same Angel of Death who was with the Northmen on the banks of the Volga. Apparently, each tribe had an old woman who performed shamanistic functions and was referred to as the Angel of Death. It is thus a generic term. Return to text. Page 135. The night banquet was much as the previous one, although there were fewer of Hrothgar's nobles and earls. Indeed, I learned that many nobles would not attend at all, for fear of what would happen in the Hurot Hall that night, for it seemed that this place was the center of the fiend's interest in the area, that he coveted Hurot Hall or some similar thing. I could not be sure of the meaning. This banquet was not enjoyable to me, for reason of my apprehension of coming events. However, this event occurred, one of the elderly nobles spoke some Latin, and also some of the Iberian dialects, for he had traveled to the region of the Caliphate of Cordova as a younger man, and I engaged him in conversation. In this circumstance, I feigned knowledge that I did not have, as you shall see. He spoke to me thus, "So you are the foreigner who shall be the number 13, and I said that I was such. "You must be exceedingly brave," the old man said, "and for your bravery I salute you." To this I made some trifling polite response of the sense that I was a coward compared to the others of Bullywiff's company, which indeed was more than true. Page 136. "No matter," said the old man, who was deep in his cups, having drunk the liquor of the region, a vile substance they call mead, yet it is potent. "You are still a brave man to face the Wendel." Now I sensed that I might finally learn some matters of substance. I repeated to this old man a saying of the Northmen, which Hergar had once said to me. I said, "Animals die, friends die, and I shall die, but one thing that never dies, and that is the reputation we leave behind at our death." The old man cackled toothlessly at this. He was pleased I knew a Northman proverb. He said, "That is so, but the Wendel have a reputation too." And I replied, with the utmost indifference, "Truly, I am not aware of it." At this the old man said that I was a foreigner, and he would consent to enlighten me, and he told me this: the name of Wendel, or Winden, is a very ancient name, as old as any of the peoples of the North Country, and it means the black mist. To the Northmen this means a mist that brings, under cover of night, black fiends who murder and kill and eat the flesh of human beings. Footnote 5. The Scandinavians were apparently more impressed by the stealth and viciousness of the creatures than the fact of their cannibalism. Jensen suggests that cannibalism might be abhorrent to the Norsemen because it made entry into Valhalla more difficult. There is no evidence for this view. However, for Ibn Fadlan, with his extensive erudition, the notion of cannibalism may have implied some difficulties in the afterlife. The Eater of the Dead is a well-known creature of Egyptian mythology, a fearsome beast with the head of a crocodile, the trunk of a lion, and the back of a hippopotamus. This Eater of the Dead devours the wicked after their judgment. It is worth remembering that for most of man's history, ritual cannibalism in one form or another, for one reason or another, was neither rare nor remarkable. Peking man and Neanderthal man were both apparently cannibals. So were, at various times, the Scythians, the Chinese, the Irish, the Peruvians, the Mayaruna, the Jagus, the Egyptians, the Australian Aborigines, the Maoris, the Greeks, the Hurons, the Iroquois, the Pawnees, and the Ashanti. During the time Ibn Fadlan was in Scandinavia, other Arab traders were in China, where they recorded that human flesh, referred to as two-legged mutton, was openly and legally sold in markets. Martinson suggests that the Northmen found the Wendel cannibalism repellent because they believed that the flesh of warriors was fed to women, particularly the mother of the Wendel. There is no evidence for this view either, but it would certainly make a Norse warrior's death more shameful. Return to text. Page 137. The fiends are hairy and loathsome to touch and smell. They are fierce and cunning. They speak no language of any man, and yet converse among themselves. They come with the night fog and disappear by day, to where no man durst follow. Page 138. The old man said to me thus, "You can know the regions where dwell the fiends of the black mist by many ways. From time to time, warriors on horse may hunt a stag with dogs, chasing the stag over hill and dale for many miles of forest and open land. And then the stag comes to some marshy tarn or brackish swamp, and here it will halt, preferring to be torn to bits by the hounds rather than enter the loathsome region. Thus we know of the areas where the Wendel live, and we know that even the animals will not enter thence." I expressed over great wonderment at his tale in order to draw further words from the old man. Hurger saw me then, gave me a menacing look, but I paid him no heed. The old man continued thus, "In olden days the black mist was feared by all the Northmen of every region. Since my father and his father and his father before, no Northman has seen the black mist, and some of the young warriors counted us old fools to remember the ancient tales of their horror and depredations. Yet the chiefs of the Northmen in all the kingdoms, even in Norway, have always been prepared for the return of the black mist." Page 139. All of our towns and our fortresses are protected and defended from the land. Since the time of the father of my father's father, our peoples have thus acted, and never have we seen the black mist. Now it has returned. I inquired why the black mist had returned, and he lowered his voice to speak this reply. "The black mist has come from the vanity and weakness of Hrothgar, who has offended the gods with his foolish splendor and tempted the fiends with the sighting of his great hall, which has no protection from the land. Hrothgar is old, and he knows he will not be remembered for battles fought and won, and so he built this splendid hall, which is the talk of all the world and pleases his vanity. Hrothgar acts as a god, yet he is a man, and the gods have sent the black mist to strike him down and show him humility." I said to this old man that perhaps Hrothgar was resented in the kingdom. He replied thus, "No man is so good as to be free from all evil, nor so bad as to be worth nothing. Hrothgar is a just king, and his people prospered all of his life. The wisdom and richness of his rule are here in Heorot Hall, and they are splendid. His only fault is this, that he forgot defense, for we have a saying among us, a man should never move a step from his weapons." Page 140. Hrothgar has no weapons. He is toothless and weak, and the black mist seeps freely over the land. I desired to know more, but the old man was tired and turned away from me and soon was asleep. Verily, the food and drink of Hrothgar's hospitality were much, and many of the number of earls and nobles were drowsy. Of the table of Hrothgar I shall say this, that every man had a tablecloth and plate, and spoon and knife, that the meal was boiled pork and goat and some fish too, for the Northmen much preferred boiled meat to roasted. Then there were cabbages and onions in abundance, and apples and hazelnuts. A Swedish fleshy meat was given to me that I had not tasted before. This, I was told, was elk or reindeer. The dreadful foul drink called mead is made from honey, then fermented. It is the sourest, blackest, vilest stuff ever invented by any man, and yet it is potent beyond all knowing. A few drinks, and the world spins. But I did not drink, praise Allah. Now I noticed that Bullywoof and all his company did not drink that night, or only sparingly, and Hrothgar took this as no insult, but rather acknowledged it as a natural course of things. Page 141. There was no wind that night. The candles and flames of Heorot Hall did not flicker, and yet it was damp and chill. I saw with my own eyes that out of the doors the mist was rolling in from the hills, blocking the silvered light of the moon, cloaking all in blackness.